begin. Welcome to all of you who are here. And thanks for coming, given the, I wouldn't go to a thing like theology of the toilet. But you have. And I take it lightly, but actually quite seriously. In some ways, I took this picture off the web. It's the Holy Bible sitting on the toilet. Some of you may know there's cultural wars going on. It was in the paper not too long ago in a couple of our prisons and in prisons in other countries where, for the Christian, some of those prisoners were using the Bible and tearing the pages to wipe themselves. In Islam, it was the same thing. Others were using the Quran to wipe themselves. This was not holy. So, you don't have to follow that kind of stuff. I don't follow it unless I happen to just see it. But I always like this picture of the Bible sitting on the toilet.
Did you take it?
No. Though I have taken pictures of toilet. I have a real used toilet, and I use it for all kinds of things. I have a little genuflect where you go down and pray before it. When Nancy turned 50, I did a sculpture of a toilet sitting on a pedestal with a fan. And I decorated it all with aluminum and lights. And in the Bible, there's only one word that really kind of captures it in the New Testament, skabula. And I love that. That sounds very Swedish or Norwegian. And it means shit or refuse or, you know, one of those things. And it's in Philippians when Paul is saying, you know, compared to Christ, all my education, everything that counts and means something to our culture is skabula. So then I wrote, this is when skabula hits the fan. I don't know if Nancy ever appreciated it, but I still have it boiling.
I did not appreciate it.
Okay, confession time.
It was a good conversation piece for the party.
Psalm 113. I actually have used this many times for myself, but also in context of worship. I'm going to just use the middle of the psalm, verse 4. Who is like the Lord our God, who is seated on high, who looks far down on the heavens and the earth? He raises the poor from the dust, and he lifts the needy from the dung heap. Dung is mentioned quite a few times in the scriptures, of course. Everything from the Old Testament through the New. But that psalm, and this is the result. And that's kind of why I love it up here. Because he didn't do it just to... He makes them sit with princes and princesses. With the prince and princesses of his people. So the purpose gets to be, he doesn't just do it to take them off the dung hill. Because in Jerusalem, there was a dung hill. In fact, that's how they got rid of their crap, if you will. And it became such a big hill, it got to be the dung gate. You know, they had many gates in Jerusalem, and that was one of them. And so it's very interesting that the picture of God lifting God's people from the dung heap, to be with them. Here's where this poverty stuff comes. Why, Nancy and I pushed for 24 years to have the people who we've labeled needy, depressed, sick, poor, overweight, to this, to that, and bring them to the table where our princes, I mean the heads of social agencies and stuff, and the government, to bring them to have them listen. And why I would say this, she's still a good friend, and so is her husband and her goofy kids. Her name is Rose Kirkus. She used to live in South Shamp before they moved out. She's the one that made me go to McKinley elementary school, where Roger Iverson taught for many years. He's wonderful with those kids. And she said, you got to go to this meeting. Public policy meeting. I don't want to go to a meeting. She says, you have to. This See, it wasn't me, it was her. And the point of that meeting was, how are we going to divide up this money in the community from whatever it was, community block grants or something. And I wasn't interested in that. But I got very interested in when I went to the meeting. She used to work for a ceramic person for like $1.75 an hour. The state of Washington's rate of was what, $2.50?
$2.30,
and I don't remember what the feds were at that time. Of course, we now have one of the highest hourly rates in the United States for beginning workers. But then, Seattle gave me a call, one of those poverty groups. He said, "Pastor Ron, you have anybody that would go to Olympia in Washington, that's our capital, and speak against that we raise the minimum wage?" And I used to be amazed at that. "Don't you know anybody in Seattle? That's 500,000 people. Can't find a poor person to speak up." Well, whatever reason, they didn't. So I asked Rose. I said, "Rose, would you go down there and speak up for this?" She said, "Yeah, sure." And she did. She advocated for the poor and for people who had to work for $1.75 an hour. And she was great. And she also went down there to speak for dentistry, for dental work for kids. Yeah. Some of the poverty things is their teeth are just a wreck by 5 years old, you know, that kind of thing. So she comes back. The next week she comes and gives me a call. She says, "Pastor Ron, they fired me from that wonderful job." And she went on to do wonderful things. They ran the food bank that Nancy used to actually direct over in Old Town. Danny Kirkus, her husband, still runs one at the Lutheran Food Bank over on 84th and Portland Ave. So the connections for me are always this multi-connecting thing, and it doesn't mean it makes any sense to any of you, but that's okay. God sort of ordained, if you will, that the poor will not remain on the dunghill. And by the way, that word, you know, the words of dung in our culture, of course, it wouldn't take long. I won't do it here because it almost seems, you know, like shit. But you can look it up. They got whole pages of vocabulary. And in any community work, you're going to hear that word a lot. Oh, shit. And you know, and it's just interesting because it cut. Why the bodily things? Why the body? You know, yesterday I used that wonderful verse from Ephesians 1. We are God's work of art. What a work of art he made. Look what we have to do every day. Defecate. Urinate. I asked Verlon, because he works with the real homeless that are on the bridges everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And I asked you, where do they go pee and where do they do other things?
On the side of buildings.
Side of buildings. It's very biblical, by the way.
In the bushes.
In the bushes.
They use public. The people are always kind of running them out of public restrooms. They go in there and wash up and everything else. You know, public libraries.
We don't like them using the public $350,000 toilets. It just annoys many of us middle-class folks that they would go in those toilets and use them for other things. In France, they had all these wonderful toilets outside, right, Nancy? And you pay to go in. And finally, they had to put timers on them. Guess what? Well, guess what some of our wonderful people, and they weren't all poor, by the way, were doing in the toilets?
Sex.
He happens to be right. And have you ever used those toilets? I remember the one guy who was the senator or whoever he was got caught with his foot on the other side of the divide.
I know. Yes.
Larry Craig.
Yeah, Larry Craig. Anyway, so it's no small thing, this toilet stuff. But we are God's work of art. Larry is here. And Larry.
Sorry.
I asked you the other day this. I remember your rock slides. They were just gorgeous. I mean, they were works of art. And they were slivers and light comes through. And then I asked you, because I remember this, you had slides of urine. Could you tell us how you got the urine in those slides?
You have to crystallize it.
You what?
You have to precipitate and crystallize it before you can use it that way.
Oh, okay. I always thought urine or pee was just that. You go pee and you hope it goes away. He's taking slides of it. And were they gorgeous? Oh, they were beautiful. But we couldn't see it until you did that. I'm suggesting to you, everything from Jesus' wisdom is an invitation into wisdom. Never just like a Sirach basically tells you what you should do and not do it. You better obey. You're going to get it. But Jesus' invitation is so different. It's always an invitation. It's a welcoming, like this. We welcome you into. And then he'll tell a story, like, what's one of his wisdom statements? That's Paul Enderly preached last Sunday. The Good Samaritan. How come the priest, the educated one, the elite, the ones who usually had the money and everything else, because, you know, it was only like 10% maybe of that culture that had much of anything and education, and they did the ruling and the rules. The other, what, 90% were at the mercy of that. And so, Jesus does what with that incredible text? Paul used the word, I love it, Dodgers. And I'm a Brooklyn Dodger. That's kind of what I kept coming back to. Well, you guys are Dodgers. And you hide. And you do this, you do that. And then he gets finally to, how did the Samaritan, who's despised by the Jew, see the one in need? How do you see the real need? Not the one after you've put it in the computer and came out with all your data. That's what Kierkegaard warned the church about. Warned what was going to happen. And it's happened. I don't know anybody who gets grants today. You got to have all that data before they give you a look even. Two, or money, to be sure. You better have that data. And they even call, they have names for it. Yeah, effect, no. Evident, what's it?
Evidence-based
to show that person who's peeing in the yard there, you know, we should really build them a toilet someplace, or whatever. And Kierkegaard once said, that's why I liked Heidi's stuff, because she used Kierkegaard. He said, like physics, like metaphysics, which was the idea of philosophy and as it relates to the universe and everything else. Like metaphysics that has already gone to physics, the science of physics, he said, will happen to ethics. That ethics will be replaced by statistics. Ooh. And we had somebody appeal you once. She wrote a whole book on math. And I went up to her and I told her what Kierkegaard said would happen in our time. And she was amazed. And I said, yeah, statistics. I'm not against statistics. We need statistics. But it was the use of statistics overpowering ethics. What's the right thing to do in any given situation, of course. But in particular, for people that I happen to be mentioning always behind the scenes, like in the song. And the scripture is filled with what you should be about with those folks. Okay, so that's kind of how I got somewhat involved in this toilet stuff. We are God's work of art. Who? Who's God's work of art? Do we say here all?
I got a question.
Yes. Oh, that.
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, I was wondering what did he mean by saying statistics replaced ethics. I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, anybody want to make an attempt at that? Anybody, a social worker here, or a grant writer, or anybody? Nancy is, or you know that.
So one example would be an agency like the one that I work for, which is the Tacoma Housing Authority. And I think we make some of our decisions based on ethics. We consider ourselves a social justice agency. We make some of our decisions based on what we think is good and good for the community. But much of what we decide is based on statistics. It isn't just what someone thinks is good, but can we prove that we will get certain results if we do certain things? And all that proving of the results is based on data and statistics and measurement that is dominates our life. Does that help?
Yeah,
it's a little confusing, because he was very critical of the Danish church. I mean, really critical. And for a lot of reasons, and one of them was how they count. Anyway, toilets. Anybody have any comments about toilets, or you want me to just...
I'm going to go how people react to toilets. I'm thinking of several things here. I had a professor who used to comment that when he was on the throne, he would proofread Grey's Anatomy by mistakes. But when we lived in Japan, we had the Japanese squatties, and this was the time when the international airport in Haneda opened up, and they put in Western-style facilities. And after a while, they had to put instructions on the wall on how to use them, because the Japanese were climbing up and squatting on the toilet seats. They got tired of the footprints. So that led to directions. In Japan, it's not unacceptable for men to put number one out in the grass. However, if Boy Scouts put number one on the side of a gas station, the gas station owner gets unhappy.
Very unhappy.
You also have ladies on buses, on tour buses there, and the men go out on tours, not the women. And they spend on Sunday, and they spend a lot of time drinking beer. And they will line up for the lineup to take care of the problem. And every now and then a hostess has to help the man because there's been a hang-up.
And you may, if you've traveled, have all kinds of stories like this. I got to go to Cambodia with World Vision one time. It was an interesting trip. It was three very large, wealthy churches from Bellevue, Washington.
Oh, dear.
And those leaders wanted to do some project in Cambodia, because they wanted to see how they could help. And, you know, I always question that kind of theology. But anyway, I knew about some of them. And one of the World Vision workers was a good friend. He said, would you come with us? I said, well, if you pay for me, I'll come. And so I did. And I worked with Cambodians. And by the way, I can't understand a word they say most of the time, but we communicate. I would only suggest to you, don't be afraid of the ones that can't speak our language or yours, theirs. You can still communicate. You know, see, I'm already being New Yorkish. You move your hands all over the place and the body. Two, so I go there, and we had to do a trip on, you know, Cambodia's roads? You don't want to know them. It would be the worst of whatever Holden was when it had, you know, no scrapers and this or that. And so they had a pickup truck with a front and a back seats, and it was all Cambodians, and the leader of the trip says, would you go with them, Pastor Ron? Because, you know, they don't seem to mind. I said, no, I don't mind. We're right here. So I sit with them, and we're driving along, and we're bumping and bumping. You know, our bladders are going. And so the guy stops the truck, and the driver, and he gets out, and he says, go home. Oh, I thought he was going home. And I didn't see any homes. And so he goes into the woods, and he comes back. I said, you live here? He, they knew a little English, you know, live, and they started laughing. I said, go gnome. I said, what's gnome? He said, go pee. I just died. I said, oh, that's the only word I ever remember from Cambodia. You know, at least you know the essential language. And there's one related. The word sounds similar too. Eating. Always found that interesting. Because where our waste comes from is where? Well, I'm talking about bodily waste.
What goes in?
What goes in? Former cook.
That's right, absolutely.
How come you couldn't develop something that it wouldn't have to go?
I'm working on it.
Thanks, Dave. And then he called the crowd to him and he said to them, listen and understand, Jesus, his wisdom. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but it's what comes out of the mouth that defiles. Then the disciples approached and said to him, do you know what the Pharisees took offense when they heard what you said? And he answered, every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. This is one of his proverbs. And if one blind person guides another, both will what?
Fall into the pit.
That's a proverb. That's kind of the wisdom literature of Jesus. And he still goes on. He said, but Peter said to him, explain this parable to us. And then he said, are you also still without understanding? Yes. Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth enters the stomach and goes out into the sewer? I always like that. It's the one verse where you have a sewer or something of a toilet. And then he says, what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. Now this is what defiles. For out of the heart comes evil intentions, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile. Now, we got signs everywhere. You leave the little bathroom, you better wash your hands. You got to wash 1,600 times if you do dish team. And that's for hygienic reasons. And that's acceptable, I think. It has nothing to do with what Jesus was really trying to invite us to see differently. It's not that you ate the wrong food or you didn't clean. It's what comes out of your heart. And the heart would have been his mind, your mind also. They don't separate the two like we tend to. Okay. I just want to, Deuteronomy 23. These are ones you don't want to teach your kids mostly. No one whose testicles are crushed or whose penis is cut off shall be admitted to the assembly of God. Now, I don't know what kind of I can just see these little boys going.
You mean the church?
Thank you, Deuteronomy. Those born of an illicit union shall not be admitted, and then there's all these thou shalt nots. Even the 10th generation, no descendant shall be admitted to the assembly. No Amorite or Moabite shall be admitted to the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of those descendants shall be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. The Moabites you're going to find in one of the stories that I will kind of read. It's an ugly story, but it's a left-handed story. And what do we know about the left hand in certainly Eastern Near East? What's that?
You wipe with it. You wipe with it.
You wipe what?
Your butt.
Oh, your butt. Okay. So you never would go to an Arab and shake hands with the left hand. I mean, they would just
shoot you.
Yeah, might shoot you. And because guess what they didn't have in all of those cultures? They still don't. It's called toilet paper.
Kirkland toilet paper.
Now, just so we know, when did toilet paper come into our culture? Anybody know? Yeah, I got it out of the porcelain.
Mid-1800s.
Who said that? You're right. 1857 was the first time that the toilet roll started. You know, and I'm thinking, wow, that's recent. What the heck were we wiping ourselves with all those other years? To say nothing of the laundry mats today.
What are you going to do with those diapers?
Anyway. So it's an interesting, and I won't go through all of them. When you're encamped against your enemies, you shall guard against any impropriety. If one of you becomes unclean because of a nocturnal emission, then he shall go outside the camp. He must not come within the camp. When evening comes, he shall wash himself with water, and when the sun has set, he may come back into the camp. You shall have a designated area outside of the camp in which you shall go. Go for what? You know.
I gotta go.
Oh. We use that language even today. A go for what? Gotta defecate. Outside. And then he goes, you shall have, when the sun has set, he may come back into the camp. You shall have a designated area outside the camp, which you shall go. With the utensils, you should save a trowel. And when you relieve yourself outside, you shall dig a hole with it and then cover up the excrement. Because the Lord your God travels along with your camp to save you and your hand over your enemies to you. Therefore, your camp must be holy, so they may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. That's Deuteronomy 23. That's an interesting picture, isn't it? Again, it gets at that holiness stuff. And if you move from Deuteronomy to Jesus, one of the biggest things he does is offends the Hebrew, the Jew, his purity system. It's not to say, oh, we don't have that. This country is obsessed with purity. Now, you disagree with me if you like. What do I mean?
Everything has to be clean.
I mean,
cleanliness is next to godliness.
Or higher. You ever go to a grocery store?
You mean the prayer containers at the entrance?
And all the aisles of clean stuff.
$1 billion.
But what do we really have as purity versus what certainly during Jesus' time would have had? God is a punitive, I'll just use this other one, the righteous. And then you have people that some of us work with, the outcasts, the sinners. And they often were labeled that way because they just didn't. They didn't do the right thing. And if they did, they wouldn't be in this mess. When we first started at Eastside, Tacoma, there was a church there, and it's still there. And they used to meet. They didn't want to, they were a former Baptist, but they kind of changed some of their theology. And I remember I became friends with them. And they had six pastors, not all paid. And I remember how disappointed they were with the people who lived in this community called Salishan. And I said, why, Tim Hay in particular, just a scholar, by the way, and he started a Messiah church after that, and he moved out and has his own ministry. He used to teach at PLU, Hebrew. And so I said, why don't you think your congregation is making any movement towards helping people living there? About 3,500, very mixed, And he said to me, with tears in his eyes, he said, well, you know, if they just believed in Jesus, basically the way he does in his congregation, then they wouldn't be in this mess. That's pretty old theology. You know, if you gotta blame somebody for what mess they're in, blame they just don't have what you have, and they ain't gonna get it. And so that's where Dan, I always said this, wonderfully preached at our installation, when it was still the ALC, the LCA, and the Missouri. Even Missouri was there. And he said, Pastor Ron will not be bringing God here. God is already here. That's my Orthodox theology, by the way. I'm not bringing the Spirit there. I mean, isn't God the creator of the universe and everything therein? And so what do you bring? Well, bring in this thing called a work of art. At least it sounds better that way. A poema. I'll be present with that. And only then does this Trinity, finally, as an icon, as an image of how God now wants what? They're made to invite you into how God sees you, how God sees the poor. You already heard it in the song. How God sees the mess you and I really are in not doing what we already know often needs to be done. And there's where I go a little bit into the data thing, because sometimes we can't get beyond that. Sal Shan, Nancy's correct, and especially under the recent director. Since I've been there, there was like, what, five directors? And they ain't all been good. But this one, Michael Mira, is not a Christian, but he has that sense of justice and social understanding for the people who finally live together in that community. And so the purity system is where, you know, I mean, who's left out most of the time in all the talk? Women. Who's included? Men. And I just want you to, this is the kind of stuff that Jesus finally gets in trouble for. Because he's inviting. And he's using language, by the way. You know, there's three words all related. To voke, or vocation, to calling, right? You know, do you know your calling? And the three words, and I've been part of those three words, and so have you. When I was at PLU, I used to have to do the invocation for the football team. I hated that. Yes, don't hurt each other. I mean, we wanted to hurt him and win the game. And even if Frosty Westring had this theology of win-win, you didn't win-win. You either won or you lost. And you could phrase it that way, but it wasn't true. So to invoke is to call in the context of the Christian, call upon God to be with us. Two, the second one is what I used to like to do, and I don't do much of it anymore, is provoke. Call into question. I gotta provoke you till you have to answer. And it's in today's language, I'm going to call you out right there in the community. And you get in trouble a lot of times if you do that, by the way. So I got in trouble, but I just kind of walked away eventually. I didn't have to stick with them. So provocative, provoke. This is a method of trying to bring your message across. WTO. I didn't see the little goodie. Did anybody see WTO yet last night? What, was it good?
Yeah.
Great. What would you say was a kind of main point? Were they provocative?
Some were. Race consciousness and maybe in two different styles. Because that's what John mentioned, or was it, at the end. That. And I think there was a little bit of reflectiveness involved since the mayor and the... The chief of police resigned afterwards and then later said it was a regretful, mm-hmm. regretful moment. And then there were some very reflective statements by, was it Paul Schell, the mayor?
Yeah.
Is that right? So I thought it was done very well, and I thought it was edited well considering it was 26 minutes. Got a lot of information.
It's
good.
Yeah, thanks, Dougie. You see, WTO, the new provost at Gonzaga University, anybody know Gonzaga? Nobody. Anyway, it's a Catholic university outside of Spokane. And Patricia Killen, who was at PLU and was the recent provost, wrote a book on the Pacific Northwest and public life, The Nun Zone. And it was based on statistics. That when people were asked what religion you were, a lot of them, or denomination did you follow, they'd say none. And she didn't mean N-U-N, she meant N-O-N-E. And now it's been taken over, by the way, out east somewhere, either Maine or Vermont, I don't remember. But she said, and did a whole session on WTO, she said that could never have happened in most other places. Meaning, the kinds of people that actually got together, some of them were reflected. Some of them were not provocative and breaking windows and all of that kind of stuff. But they were thoughtful. And she said, "You groups that normally would not come together came together." And I've always thought her analysis was a good one. And I hope that's, that thing does that. The last one is where, at my age and experience, is evocative, or to evoke. Evoke what? From you, from your experience. To evoke the very spirit. This is a very evocative invitation. Okay? From the table, to be part of the Eucharist, or the thanksgiving, the gratitude. So evoke is, how can I evoke you, not your anger, not your, you know, that gene that Heidi talks about, the violence gene or whatever, but this other genetic makeup of our work of art, meaning our bodies. Okay, so I say that because I think Jesus' work has always been invitation. Tries to invite you, but for a purpose. See, that psalm had a purpose. It didn't just take you off the dunghill, but it was to put you with the prince and princesses of your people. So now you had voice. Now you even had a body that could come. And if you read the New Testament, of course, what is Jesus' healings always about? I mean, almost all of them. The healing was always a miracle, but what happened to the people healed?
They were restored to the community.
They were restored. And some of them wanted to follow him. No, no, no. You go back. Go back to mom, dad, and your uncle, and your the ones you hate. And tell them about what happened to you. You understand? And often, it's always restoring you into a community that can be what we hope all communities can be. Places of healing. Places where you can allow that which you are to be shared. And certainly all the stuff that we talk about, gifts and da-da-da. And you know, I'm glad you're working on this thing where we you know, I mean, that would be an energy saver. You know, no more flatulence. You know, I used to be against the law, you know, and monastery, you didn't fart. And there was a reason, because if you did, and you smelled it, that might have allowed the demons to come in. That's why Luther is so ridiculous sometimes. I mean, he loves to talk like that. And I think he had a bowel problem and a constipation. You know, there's no question about this guy had some problems with flatulence. You know, when he said a lot of things about the devil, but one of them that I always liked, he said, when faced with the devil, roll over and fart in his face. Teach your kids that. I can just see
it.
Maybe just roll over and do it to him. And I know he has other ones where we prefer the inkwell. Did you see the devil throw the inkwell? But, yeah, so.
I don't think children have a problem with farting.
No, no. Actually, they don't have much problem with any of these things.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's us adults as we grow, and we don't want to talk about it, obviously.
Parents get upset with children. Yeah. Get to a certain age, and they proceed to do that.
Right.
Then we get one of those parental, thou shalt not.
There's a children's book, Everybody Poops, and then there's Everybody Farts.
By the way, some of the best books on this, potty and pooping and peeing and everything, is children's books. Some of them are really excellent. And I recommend them. Okay, we're going to go now, because Deuteronomy actually mentions this, to, and I don't read 2 Kings. I mean, I can't even read through the names unless I figure out what the heck they're saying. But this particular story I like because it's left-handed. And that's a clue. This guy is not going to be doing something that actually the Lord is happy with.
Okay.
Yeah. So, 2 Kings. But the Rabshakeh said to him, "Has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you and not to the people sitting on the wall?" Oh, no, I'm giving you the wrong one, but this is okay. Sitting on the wall, who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and to drink their own urine. Now, these guys sitting on the wall were isolated from where they could go out because they're fighting the Babylonians. Okay? And they used to be away for months. And you can get this picture. What do you think eating your dung and urine, is that something the purity code of the Hebrew would understand? You aren't even to go near that stuff, no less eat it. And so in this particular, then a Rabshakeh stood up and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah, "Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you out of my hand." And it goes on, and it's an interesting story. The one I do want to read, though, is from Judges. This is the left-handed story. Some of you may know it. I don't remember it. I do remember it because it was so graphically ugly. So if you're a little squeamish, you can go out.
These great boys love
this,
Ron. These great boys love this.
They love
this?
Tell me why they like it, then, Nancy.
Oh, because all the gore and the description.
So, if you're a teacher and you really want to impress your students, you read this story to them.
She really is something.
Okay. The Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened King Eglon of Moab against Israel because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. In alliance with the Amorites and the Amalekites, he went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. So the Israelites served King Eglon of Moab for 18 years. But when the Israelites cried out to the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, or how do you say that? Doesn't matter. Ehud, son of Jerah, the Benjamite. See, that's where our Benjamin stuff comes in. A left-handed man. Any other left-handed people here? Woo. One, two, three, four. Are we the right ones?
We're the right minds.
By the way, it's amazing to study left-handedness, by the way. In the new brain research. Okay, so Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, and he fastened it on his right thigh under his clothes. Then he presented the tribute, or whatever they were giving, to King Eglon of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. That's easy to see. And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent the people who carried the tribute on their way. But he himself turned back at the sculptured stones near Gilgal. And he said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." So the king said, "Silence." And all his attendants went out from his presence. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. Guess what that chamber was? It was that's where they defecated. And he had his own, of course, he's a king, and said, "I have a message from God for you." So he rose from his seat. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, he thrust it into Eglon's belly. The hilt, you know, that end, went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, where he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the dirt came out. And the dirt would be anything from, eventual feces to whatever's in our intestines. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule. He closed the doors of the roof chamber on him, and he locked them. And after he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, he must be relieving himself in the cool chamber. That's what it was used for. So they waited until they were embarrassed. When he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and they opened them. And there was their Lord lying dead on the floor. Ehud escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the sculptured stones and escaped to Sarara. And then it goes on that. The escape, though, was, according to tradition, how did he escape? The doors were locked. There's this chamber where the poop and all went down. That's what he went down. And then probably brushed himself off and walked right by the folks supposed to be guarding their master. And anyway, that's another story you may want to bring to your Sunday school. Nancy, did you use that story a lot?
Yeah, I use all of the stories in Judges with the covering and confirmation. Because they're really good ways. They're really great. I mean, they're suspenseful and exciting. You have Gideon and Deborah and all these folks. And they don't, they haven't heard them in Sunday school, especially about, you know, Abraham, King Moab. And they love them because they're, you know, they're suspenseful and descriptive and...
Right.
Yeah, they get excited. Oh, this stuff's in the Bible, you bet. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, that's fun. And there's lots of others that you could...
Ron, you know that how many people have seen Slumdog Millionaire, you know, the movie charts. Slumdog Millionaire, the kid to be able to get up and meet, what is it, soccer playing? Is it some famous soccer player?
Who's an actor?
The kid goes down to the toilet and into the, I mean, he does that.
Is that right?
And he's covered in, you know, shit. So,
right.
So the way part so he can get up and meet the famous
Okay. Let me just read you a little section of the Lutheran thing. How archaeologists and all found out about monasteries, guess where they went to see how they lived their life? The Seneca. Learn a lot from toilets. And anybody knows, we were in France, and I made sure Nancy and I went there, and we did, to the sewers, because Victor Hugo, what did he say in that wonderful musical? I never can say the word. Miserably. And he said, in the sewers is all of life. And that's where you would find out what's really going on. And it's a great musical if you haven't seen it. Heard the music. So we went, I was amazed. I think I was amazed because it was so big. It wasn't like what I'm thinking of sewers, like here, you know, just little pipes. No, these were huge tunnels. And then how they would get rid of the excrement and all other things that they found in these, in the French sewers. And that's one of the first cities that had that extensive sanitation system. Okay, theologian Martin Luther, 1514-1540, represents the thoughtful, anguished soul of a man of God. Luther's famous 90 Theses, criticizing the Roman Catholic Church, did not come to him in the form of a miraculous thunderbolt. Rather, Luther's contemplations on the role of the church were slow and torturous in coming, frequently stricken with constipation. Luther had plenty of time to deliberate on the evils of the church. God's call for service came early in Luther's life, as did his bowel trouble. According to his own writings, Luther first considered becoming a monk while sitting on the necessary, quote unquote. Necessary was how they described where you would defecate or urinate, right? The necessary. I like that. It's a thing. So maybe we'll change our language. And defecating. In this holiest of sanctuaries, Martin thought about his father's request that he marry a young lady of wealthy means. Suddenly, Luther cried out, "Help me, St. Anne. I want to become a monk." However, after the initial pain passed, he had second thoughts. So if you're constipated, beware. And in the end, of course, Luther avoided marriage and joined the church. But also then he did what? He married a former nun who was in a fish barrel or something or other. And it's just a wonderful story. I won't go on with that anymore. This book is just filled with this. This was her thesis. So she has some really interesting stories. And it's already 10-2. What's that?
Is that the porcelain god?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's this.
Is that in the bookstore?
No. Oh. No, or no. I don't know where it is. I didn't look it up on Amazon and they show up. It's not that old, 96. Could still be around. Okay. Oh, here's. In the 15th century, travelers to the Holy Land had to learn to survive for months on the open sea. The necessities of life could not be ignored: food, water, and going to the bathroom. A Dominican monk, Felix Faber of Ulm, traveled as a pilgrim from Europe to the Holy Lands in 1480 to 1483. He gives an astonishing portrayal of his life on the open sea in A History of a Private Life. He says, as the poet says, a ripe turd is an unbearable burden. You know, these things are all through poetry and books and novels, and we tend not to mention them because we're still, strangely, as a culture, don't want to use the reality of what we are. And I think that as adults, not the kids, we often then betray them down the road with our, what do you call it when you're tight, but what do they call that?
Anal
retentive. you can just feel it, right? Just hold it in, until eventually you explode or you gotta do something. So, yeah.
One time I saw in a catalog, it's been a long time, and I wish I would have bought one, but there was a t-shirt that had a cross in front of it. Does anal retentive have a hyphen?
I couldn't hear that pearl of wisdom.
What was it?
Does anal retentive have a hyphen?
A question. On a t-shirt.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can find them all over the place. A few words on the manner of urinating and shitting on the boat. Now, this is their words. This is his words. Each pilgrim has near his bed a urinal, a vessel of terracotta, small bottle in which he urinates and vomits. But since the quarters are cramped for a number of people and dark besides, and since there is so much coming and going, it's seldom that these vessels are not overturned before dawn. Quite regularly, in fact, driven by a pressing urge that obliges him to get up, some clumsy fellow will knock over 5 or 6 urinals in bed, giving rise to an horrible stench. Oh, well. And then she has this disposable dung and all. I won't go into any of that for now.
You know, I've often thought with the food stamps, you were mentioning that when Jesus heals, that invites people back into the community.
Right.
And food stamps does not allow any cleaning products or toilet paper and all that
right.
stuff. And I don't think they planned it that way, but to me it's almost like saying, we will feed you so that you can live, but we don't want you back in the community. Because cleanliness is very important, but we can't give you anything to make you clean. And it just, every time I go down to the food pantry to work, I always bring toilet paper and soap. Because it's something you cannot buy with food stamps.
That's an interesting analysis. It'd be worth kind of looking into that someday.
Well, it's all over. It's, I think it's federal law.
You cannot use.
So for our 24 years, and we always had food right from the beginning, right to the end, and they even tried to do some of that now, and we got it free, the food piece. But always, they didn't always want food. What they wanted was toilet paper.
Right. And soap.
They wanted soap.
Soap.
sanitarium.
They need it. And if they're in prison, it's the same thing. Because you realize you can put money on people's books. And if you talk to Eric, who's our, he'll be teaching next week. Why? I mean, I used to get Yolanda Pouncey, Nancy, she always, Pastor Ron, I need women's hygienic stuff. Well, they'll give you the prison stuff. It's not quite the same as choosing something that you would like and feel more dignity as a human being. And so that's correct. And I don't, you know, that's a little cynical, but I would even go worse than that, yeah. And when the days of food stamps, they don't have food stamps now.
No,
though they call them food stamps. What do they have?
Debit cards.
Yeah, a little debit card. And in the old drug days, food stamps, a lot of my drug folky folks would sell them. And they'd sell them for drugs, even though their kids are not eating. And that's why it was very difficult over the years. I refused not to give them help. And a lot of times we gave out a food box, you know, with all of whatever the government gave away. You know, because we got whole store, we got whole Copper Mountains filled with stored up food that we can't sell because it would destroy the market. You know, that kind of thing. And so often we'd give them a Safeway. In those days, we're paper also. Today, everything's a debit card. Thank you for that. Well, it's 10 o'clock, I think. I'd like to read this little letter to you from a senator from Minnesota. How many Minnesotans here?
One.
Two, three, four, five. Okay. This is from John Marty. He will be here in August sometime. His brother was here, right, recently? He says, greetings from Minnesota. I don't remember how many years ago you were serving as the Holden, both Nancy and I, the Holden Summer Program Coordinators, when I was on teaching staff. But I'm guessing that it was close to 20 years ago. I think our paths have crossed at Holden a couple of times since. I hope all is well with you. When I looked for your address, I saw your nice Tacoma News Tribune article on your retirement from the South Shand Ministry. So, see that you are, you and Nancy are still active in social ministry. I love this piece, though. He says, I'm writing for a very unusual reason. Somehow, I'm not sure quite how, my wife acquired a painting of you. If you only knew what a big ego I have about this kind of stuff. And he goes on to say, apparently you were an intern pastor, which is not true, at Nativity Lutheran in St. Anthony Park during your Luther seminary years. And some woman painted and framed a small 8x10 oil portrait of you wearing a white alb. I know where that came from. It was a picture taken here. Nancy, do you remember when we blessed the fish?
Yeah.
Meredith Olson?
Yeah.
And there was one picture that's just gorgeous. I don't know. It's like a, it's in the museum picture thing. Oil portrait of you wearing a white alb. There is a note taped on the outside that it was painted by Alta Witzingham, 1908 to 2008. She's one of those centurions, or centurion, whatever, 100 years old. So this must have been disposed of by her estate at that time. It gives her daughter Cynthia's name and number. I think she's dropped it off at a nonprofit thrift shop that my wife volunteered out.
There goes a lot of nerve.
God will prevail. And he goes on to say, and they gave it to her because we were members of Nativity for a number of years, and they didn't know what to do with it. Do you have any interest in painting of yourself from the days when your beard was dark? I don't like him anymore. Mind me, aging. I will be on teaching staff in late August. Bring it to Holden. We travel light, so it wouldn't be a problem to get it there. But you will be long gone by then. And I don't know if you get there frequently. I'd be happy to mail it to you. In the meantime, I hope you have a good week at Holden, John Martin. Isn't that special?
Yes.
That's a picture of when you were dark and handsome.
I'm going to
warn him about
handsome.
Himself. Well, thank you all for being so kind to attend and to pay attention. I hope you think of icons as a portrait of God, part of the family of God, and that's how they often Orthodoxy sees it. Visit an Orthodox church if you've never. It's just different, but wonderful. And when they say wisdom, as I told you, the assistant says be attentive or pay attention. And to what? To the reading, to the Word of God that's being shared with you so graciously. And that's kind of how I see this community here. And then you go about your business and do whatever you need to do. So once again, thank you, Jeannie, and your husband, for and others, whoever made the decisions, but to invite Nancy and I up.
Thank you.